This is the Made of Clay Report, and I'm your host, Eric Clay, and our guest on this hour is Richie Holtz. Richie, it's good to have you here this morning.
Nice to be here.
So Richie, the way we start the show and is with the question, who are you? And you can take that, you know, any one of a number of ways. What labels do you wear? What are some a couple of defining experiences? You know, what do we need to know to start the conversation?
Well, they say I'm a nice guy, so let's start with that.
I've actually heard that myself.
It's just a rumor. Yes. let's see. I'd say that I would, if I had to define myself, I'm a musician. Mm-hmm. I am a teacher of children. I am a friend of friends, and I am a husband and father. Mm-hmm. And I am someone who had a kidney transplant. That's a good start. Yeah, any of those and all of those things and more.
much more. Like, this is just where we start, and there, you've already given enough to talk for a day on, just in the in what you've alluded to there and stated there. You also brought some music, and we're going to start with Bruce Cockburn's One
Coburn.
Day.
Coburn.
Oh,
Bruce Coburn.
Bruce Coburn. Yeah, yeah. Okay, Bruce Coburn's One Day I Walk. Do you want to say something before we play that or after we play it?
I'll just say something quickly before it. I think it's just a beautiful song. It's played so well. The words are really nice. It's just this mystical feeling about it. Just listen to it.
Yes.
Oh, I have been a beggar and shall be one. And few the ones with help to lend within the world of men. One day I walk in flowers, one day.
That was Bruce Coburn and One Day I Walk. And our guest on this hour is Richie Holtz. And Richie was helping me to understand that I've heard that name pronounced for years. And I've loved that song for years, but I've never seen it his name written. So I mispronounced it right off the fly. And I've actually done that sometimes with guests on the show. But you're telling me you're a lover of words.
I do. I love words, yes.
Yes.
So I work with children a bunch. I'm a retired teacher, but I still substitute teach most days. And I like to come up with different kinds of games or stories and add their ideas into the story and just try to cultivate language and ideas. I also love doing puzzles and crossword puzzles and all sorts of puzzles because it's one way of really focusing, and I'll just sit there until I get it. It's one thing I really can focus on.
Yeah. I used to really treasure the New York Times Sunday Magazine crossword puzzle. Mm-hmm. We would spend a lot of time just making sure we got that worked through and researching it. It's fun. It's a lot of fun. But I also, but you're also playing with puns and with you know, archaic usages or made up words or you know, what is it that you hope the children will learn from your play with language?
How to use language, how to make it work for them, I guess.
Uh-huh.
I also do a lot of puns around friends, and so you can imagine there's a lot of groans.
Well, yes.
And sometimes I just know they're funny, and sometimes I know they just don't get it, and sometimes they get it, and it's groan-worthy anyway.
Yeah. No,
I'm
guilty as charged, and we might as, if we're going to sin, we might as well sin boldly. That was Luther's advice.
Well, it seems to me that it just, if people talk about muse, fortunately or unfortunately, one of my muses is having this stuff just bubble up out of me all the time. I can't help it. I mean, I could shut my mouth, but then I'd be constipated.
Right. Or what happens, your mind makes the association so quickly that you don't dance with yourself. You suddenly shut down. And there's a beauty to having that connection and to learning that repartee. And I grew up in a verbal culture where, you know, people who were kind of rigid or prissy would memorize Bible verses and, you know, to do that kind of thing. But for those of us who just wanted to play, we would even create music back and forth. We would create lyrics and melody and sing our conversation back and forth just because that was fun.
And you're saying the word play, so there's playing with words, so that's actual, you know, activity to do. Kids like to play hands-on stuff and make believe. Well, there's playing with words, there's playing instruments. So play to me is really important. It's just what kind of play works for me.
Right. And yeah. And also how you carry your friends into your playtime.
Yes. And which actually would be a good lead into playing music.
Sure.
Because for many years I traveled, and I hope to talk some about that also at some point, but now I just want to bring up that while traveling, I'd get together with lots of people. This is back in the 70s and 80s. We would just meet on the road somewhere in some country, and music would be what we would do every night. We'd just get together and play music. And it just became sort of established that for years and years, almost every night, a group of us would get together and sing and play. And so when I moved to Ithaca in 1986, I wanted to try to replicate that, although life at that point was a little bit more, if maybe regimented. I had a job, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And so it was hard to get together every night and play. But I tried to get together with people and just sing together. And we managed, I'd say, maybe three times a year, twice a year, I'd get together with people, and that just didn't suffice for my needs.
Right.
So I finally started a monthly sing, and that started, it was like Labor Day 1993. So this is something that's been going on without missing a month for over 22 years now.
Wow.
It came out of, for me, a need to just get together with people and sing and play, and it has continued, and we had a sing last night, and it's still very vital.
And how many people are participating? Where are you doing this?
Well, it rotates in a non-specific order. You know, somebody will just volunteer. We have one person in the group who is like our secretary or organizer.
Right.
And she puts out to people on the listserv where we need somebody for so-and-so month and so-and-so month. And somebody will volunteer. Once in a while, we use the Friends Meeting House here on 3rd Street. Mm-hmm. So we usually meet in someone's house, which is nice, but sometimes there's so many people that it is a little tight. And the Friends Meeting House is a larger space, which is pretty nice. But anyway, so we have a potluck dinner, and then we just start to sing, and people suggest songs. Some people lead songs. It's been a great thing.
I come from a background where in my grandparents' generation, on both sides, my grandfathers had double quartets in among both of their siblings, and they would do these kinds of sings. They would get together routinely. We also grew up singing at home. I'm one of seven kids, and that was just part of what we did. And we did it in lieu of listening to the radio in the car, because oftentimes we didn't have a radio in the car.
And this actually is something that creates community because people join. People, you know, you come when you want to come. You don't have to, we don't take attendance or anything like that. But people show up. People become friends. People become lovers. People start doing things together. As a matter of fact, to divert somewhere else, over 10 years ago, I needed a kidney transplant, and I thought to myself, well, when this actually happens, when I get it, and when I'm in recovery, people often expect their church or their synagogue to come to their aid, and I'm not really part of either of those institutions. And I was thinking at first, well, where's my support from? Well, teachers came through making dinners, seeing people. We have a play reading group. It just turned out that I was well supported, and I found out that I was part of a community, part of which I helped to create, and part of it I joined.
Didn't know that it existed.
I guess I knew that it existed, but yes, I guess not in that way, because until you test something like that out, you don't know how far it will go. Something like a church or a synagogue, they're kind of set up for something like that.
You would be surprised, having worked in a number and in a consulting capacity with more. Many times that function will get lost, or if they began more as a matter of social status and less as a matter of community, then those ways of being in each other's lives with food and in your face and showing up at your house, those things don't necessarily happen in religious congregations of any tradition, unless people value community. Right. We're a funny place because, you know, Tompkins County's population is the only place up in upstate New York that has doubled in the last 50, 60 years. And we have a ready flow through of 30 or 40% of the people that are here for education in some form or teaching, and they're out. So we have people who haven't learned those institutionalized community ways, and we're relearning them. And your story is really common. For the last 20 or 30 years, people will discover they're in a community and not have realized it. And it takes about, my experience, 10 to 20 years for that to kind of form and somewhat institutionalize, not too much, so it doesn't lose its fuzzy edges.
Well, I'm also noticing that another group that I'm part of is a Sunday morning hike, which I'm not on today, but I've missed quite a few. But it started out quite a few years ago with a handful of people walking, and maybe 5 years ago, we started a once-a-year picnic in the summertime. Now there's well over 100 people, and it seems like very often after a hike there's a get together at someone's house, and so people learn to, they get together, become friendly with each other, want to share things with each other, and it's just the way I guess a community builds.
And completely kind of organically, without anybody doing any more than their part. So can you, I mean, we've already launched into some really interesting and stuff. And the question I would normally ask coming out of the first song is, what major experience or experiences have defined your life? And you've just given me a whole number of things that have helped to greatly shape the quality of your life and the fact of your life. But what were some early experiences that opened you up to this way of living?
Well, I guess the first thing was the Beatles. I was 13 years old in 1963, making me a 65 right now. And when they came up out, I woke up. There was something that I was passionate about. I don't think I recognized passion before then, but their music really did it for me.
Puberty, passion, and the Beatles.
And maybe in that order. Another thing, I guess, there was college, and this is the 60s, so mm-hmm. it was a hotbed of trying new things. Mm-hmm. And I quit college fairly early on to start traveling because I heard so many stories that people told about their travels. So I did travel around this country. I went to Europe and North Africa and Asia and just met lots of people. And you're always getting into new situations because you might be with someone for a few hours or a few days or a few weeks or a few months. Mm-hmm. And there's a constant shift of who you're hanging out with, or sometimes maybe even alone. And so somehow you have to find your place in each of those situations.
Yep.
And I mean, it's not necessarily a conscious decision, but you had to keep on trying new things or hitchhiking. Hitchhiked a lot back in the mm-hmm. in the 60s, and you get picked up by some people who are questionable, not in terms of safety as far as I was concerned, but maybe they just had a lot of biases or this or that. And I was going to be in the truck or the car with them for a number of hours. I mean, I guess I could have just said, I'm out of here and gotten out, but I would stay because maybe I was being opportunistic. I needed the ride to the next place.
Right.
And so I had to learn how to find common ground with each of the people that I was with, however short amount of time.
Right. And was it common ground, or was it an ability to have a conversation? Because they're not quite the same.
Well, maybe, I don't know, maybe it's finding the humanity in the person.
Right.
I don't know if I know the difference.
Yeah, no. Okay. Our curiosity about each other oftentimes propels us into conversation, where all that we have in common is we have a similar definition of the words we're using. But we have this,
and also
curiosity.
We're sharing the same space.
Yeah, we share the same space. Yeah, and we figure, and we're not going to sit in silence because there's something about the silence that we want to break. Or I've been in situations where you just want to stay in silence for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But I imagine you have too in some of those rides where that was the most honest response. You were part of a time where people took to the road. And that had been happening in this culture in a larger sense for 10 or 20 years at that point. How did you, and this is more for people who are younger, how did you support yourself on the road?
Well, sometimes I would come back to home, wherever that might be, and work for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I would get very short-term jobs at the place I was at. Like, for instance, in Holland, I spent a couple of days scraping the inside of a hull of a boat, which was terrible work, but it enabled me to buy new shoes, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
I picked grapes in France for a month, 3 weeks, and earned some money doing that. You didn't need much money back then. Just like in those days, college didn't cost a lot, and now it's just out of sight. You could support yourself quite easily on not very much money. So it was a different time. As a matter of fact, I'm a substitute teacher, but when I was a teacher for many years,
mm-hmm.
I'd have college students coming into the classroom to help out, maybe as part of a practicum or a student teaching situation. And I would often say to them, well, what are you going to do next? And they often would say, well, I'm going to just go get a job. I got to pay back these loans. And for many years, I said something like, well, don't you want to have some life experience before you just jump into teaching? Because what informs your teaching if you never really lived on your own?
Right.
And I say that less and less now because people are saddled with such incredible loans, and they just really have to get cracking at work. And it, to me, I guess it's what's happening, but it's really a pity that people can't experience life more now before just jumping into the grind.
Right, life as an adult or a semi-adult before that happens. I think people experience a lot these days, especially people of some affluence, where they will travel as children or youth. They will have more experiences earlier than we did when I was growing up anyway, or where I grew up. But they will have it kind of under the supervision or under a fairly close eye. It will not be an adventure kind of their own making, by their own wits, which is what you described having gone through.
Actually, my daughter got a Fulbright to teach English in a fifth grade class in Dusseldorf, Germany, back in 2007, I'm guessing. And that was still within the aegis of some sort of institution, mm-hmm, because she mm-hmm. got health insurance and she got a stipend. And after that, she just decided, I'm staying in Germany, I'm moving to Berlin, and I'm going to make a life for myself. And so she broke out of that mold at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's neat. That's really neat. I'm wondering, should we go to the Beatles song, Because?
That sounds fine.
Okay. And in many ways, these, well, let's listen to it, and then we can pick up on it later.
Okay.
And that was Because by the Beatles. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Richie Holtz. So Richie, why did you pick that song?
Well, like I mentioned for One Day I Walk, the last song we heard.
Mm-hmm, sure.
There's songs that just, I hear them and they just roll over me and they wash over me. And it just feels so beautiful. It somehow touches me sometimes. It's not necessarily the words, it's just the feeling that the song evokes. Mm-hmm. And there's a version of this song on the Beatles anthology, which is without the instrumentation. And it's It's just so gorgeous. This song is often requested at our monthly sings, and it's a really nice one to play. It's interesting to play, and in terms of singing, it it allows for lots of harmonies. And you know, whenever we're done with that song, we always say, "Wow!"
and what drew me to want to play it at that moment in our conversation was there's a quality of just being where you are in that moment and just experiencing it for the fullness that it is. I mean, in the words, in the very words, because, you know, and I was keying off the qualities that I felt when I have been a wanderer around the world, not much, but some, is that I am not tied to anything. And so I can be more present to where I am in that particular moment. And I've got a sense of that in terms of your talking about traveling around the U.S. and Europe and then connecting at nights to sing along and have the sing-alongs and stuff. Yes.
Interesting that you bring that up because
yes.
Shortly I am going to be re-retiring. meaning I retired from teaching over 10 years ago. I began working at the Tompkins County Public Library, which is where I still work. I've been doing that for over 9 years, and I sub most days. And I am shortly going to be turning 66, and I'm figuring this could be a good time to start collecting Social Security. And even though I love both of the jobs I'm doing, it's time to let other things percolate in. Like, for instance, at the library, I've given up every weekday evening for over 9 years. And if I weren't doing that, something else would percolate in, and I don't even know what it is. So the thought of giving those things up to let other things percolate in one way, it's a little bit scary because, you know, right now I know what I'm doing in the morning and I know what I'm doing in the evening.
Right.
And I thought, well, will I be able to find my way? And then I hearken back to my traveling days when I was younger, where the days weren't set. There was no time frame. Not that there's never going to be a time frame here, but I'm going to have so many hours free. And I know how to do it because I've done it in the past. I'm just going to have to recreate that and create it in a way that works for someone who's now going to be 66 instead of 22.
Right. And I guess what I would wonder about, in a wondering way.
One often wonders in a wondering way.
It's a quality of engaging life that you may have, regardless of whether you have a set appointment of time to arrive at work, but it's the way you carry your work, or it's the way you have unstructured time. And they may be the same way, you know, in terms of the quality of your attentiveness. And I wonder, yeah, because I feel it strongly in the way you are in this room, in this conversation.
Well, there's been times I went to massage school and I had to move from where I was elsewhere. And I've made a couple of moves during my life, either changing profession or changing location. And my thought always was, how am I going to fit in? And it always happened. I was able to, I wouldn't want to say insinuate my way in, but I was able to find a way of either fitting in or creating. And so with those past successes, that arms me to know that when I make this next change coming up, that I will be able to create or join in or just enjoy what comes next.
Right. And I want to stay with this topic of change. How has life kind of forced you to change in ways that you wouldn't have chosen but come to value? And what are the changes that have been harder, less welcomed?
Okay, well, as for the first part of the question, I didn't wake up when I was 13 years old when the Beatles came along and said, I would like to get a kidney transplant at some point. That wasn't part of my
That wasn't plan. Part of the plan.
Right.
Yeah.
But and I'd get lots of advice from people. Oh, you need a kidney transplant? Yeah, I mean, you need your kidneys are bad. You should try watermelon juice or grind up watermelon seeds and make it into a tea or parsley juice. And I thought to myself, you know, if I listen to every single person's recommendations, no matter how new age or whatever, I'm going to be like a roller coaster thinking, oh, this is going to cure me. Oh, it didn't. Oh, this maybe this time. Instead, I thought to myself, be wise. Be like my father. Just the kidney doctor, the nephrologist who I'm working with, he's been through hundreds and hundreds and thousands of these things. I think I'm going to listen to his advice. And everything worked out really smooth all along because I didn't allow myself to get distracted by things that just seemed, if not foolish, then not going to be successful. But the way...
like your father is what you said. What did you mean by that?
Okay, before I will talk about that.
Sure.
But I'm one way it changed me was Francesca. Francesca is a local person here who I knew just barely, and she offered me a kidney. Uh-huh. And it is still inside of me 10 years later, more than 10 years later. And so one of the ways it changed me is to realize just... she doesn't like the word hero, but just how much one can give. You know, what I do for giving is, you know, I'll help people, I donate money places, but this is like a whole step, many steps up. Yep. I'll give you one of my kidneys. And a lot of my friends felt the same way, like, wow, this person has expanded the idea of what is possible in human interactions.
Yes.
So it changed me by letting me know that there is this person out there who let me know what's possible.
And did she made the offer before she knew there was a match?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I heard that she was going to call me up and offer me one. And my thought was, I wouldn't give anybody a kidney, so I don't deserve a kidney from someone else. So I don't want to talk to her on the phone because this is not going to work. But then I said,
well, it's not going to work. It's just not right.
It's not right. Okay. Yeah. That's better. Yeah. That's better. Yeah. It's not right. But then I thought to myself, well, let me listen to what she has to say. And so she called up and she said, you know, when she first heard that I needed one, a kidney, her first reaction could have been, poor guy. But because her sister had given someone a kidney 4 years before, it was in her purview. It was something that she thought of as a possibility. And so I said, well, and I guess she really wanted to. As a matter of fact, her mother ended up giving someone a kidney a few years later. So three women in that family did that. But anyway, so I listened to her. I listened through to what she had to say. And we kept on proceeding and everything looked good. And it still does.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow.
Yes.
And I want to try to describe your situation in ways that we normally wouldn't. I've been a chaplain in a dialysis center. Actually, one of my stints was there where people needed kidneys and didn't necessarily get them, but they got the alternative. When you are so far from being whole, and somebody can come and say, "I can do this for you," and help to make you more whole. We want to cast that in heroic terms, which puts them kind of on a pedestal. But most people who offer the gift of wholeness don't want the heroics that distance us from them. And so we need to become more skillful as we talk to each other about our brokenness and need for wholeness and the offers that we can make and take or put off for various reasons and many good reasons in both directions, and just let it be how we are with one another.
Well, actually, that has to do not just with such heroic type things, but even in terms of just giving and receiving, some people find it really hard to receive. Yeah. And in a way, they don't mean it this way, but it's kind of a disservice to the person who's offering something.
Yes.
So, you know, we all have a lot to learn.
Yes, yes. One very important lesson. When I was a young chaplain and a young pastor, I would visit people in their homes, and I would turn down food or coffee or tea. You never turn down anything that's offered because it's their gift for your well-being.
Right.
And you accept it. You may eat a little bit of it or a lot of it or none of it or whatever, but you accept it and give thanks for the gift and move on to the next thing. And one of my rules as a pastor was I wouldn't let people serve others unless they had asked for help themselves. Mm-hmm. If you haven't crossed that barrier, you're probably not ready.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this woman's sister had been helped, right? Or her sister had helped
somebody else.
So, mm-hmm. So the pattern had the opportunity had been engaged.
Exactly.
Somewhere
it
else.
It was within her scope of what's possible.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So you want to talk about my father?
Sure, sure. Because that's the little line you slipped in there, and then you moved off.
You know, as I said it, I thought, oh, he's going to want to talk about my father. My father was a really good guy who I didn't get along with during my teenage years.
Because tell me a new story.
Because I was a jerk, and I knew it all. And he was very wise, and everybody in the family knew it. We didn't agree on sex, drugs, rock and roll, politics, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
Luckily, he got a kidney. Now, he didn't get a kidney transplant, but luckily he was on dialysis for 18 years, which compromised his physical body. But it enabled me to grow up enough to
know
still
him
have him around when I became a little bit more mature, shall we say. And for me to realize that, wow, if when people say that I have so-and-so quality of my father, I should be thankful because, you know, he was an honest person, a knowledgeable person, and a good person.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. Wow. And you called on him in a moment when people were buffeting you with advice that you could have gotten distracted by. And what about his perseverance or his long-suffering nature allowed you to kind of call on him for that stability? Because that's when you alluded to him.
Well, he had an evenness, an equanimity.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not in good physical shape, but you know, he'd always say he was, oh, I'm just fine, which I don't always agree with, you know, this acting like that. But
was he acting that way, or was in his heart he was fine, but his body was falling apart?
Maybe he didn't want to worry other people. This could get into a really big conversation. So I don't know exactly where to go with it, but I just felt that he had some kind of equanimity
sure,
that
sure.
Actually, I feel for the most part, I have. Life is pretty easy for me because I don't get ruffled on extraneous things, and I try to keep things simple, maybe sometimes a little too simplistic, people might say.
We don't need to go down that path, partly because what I am responding to is that somehow the child who discovered the Beatles at 13 was empowered as an agent. And you probably didn't handle that agency real well in terms of just fighting it out with your dude of a dad with whom you knew everything and he knew nothing. But that's how people become agents in the world, is they take on more than they're really ready for.
And during those times, they're jerks.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 But it just seems, that helps me understand the ease with which you describe one move after another. And equanimity can also be translated non-attachment or spiritual indifference in terms of the religious disciplines, the spiritual disciplines.
Well, there's a certain amount of non-attachment for sure, but you know, I certainly don't want to feel non-attached when it comes to my family.
No. When we're talking about it as a spiritual discipline, you do not let the attachment distort your vision.
Okay,
and some attachments bring life into focus where we actually see things, but the issue is, are they controlling you or are you seeing them?
Right, and there's also a question of desire, like how many things do you need? How many things do you want?
Yeah.
I feel for the most part that, see, I'm a terrible shopper because I don't need it. I don't need anything, but I of course I do. As a matter of fact, when I would go to the store, I would buy, oh, we need a cabbage and we need an apple and maybe an orange. And
yeah.
My wife took over that function, and she gets all kinds of stuff like the nuts and seeds and the this and that. And I love it. You know, I'm glad to pay for it, you know, but I don't even think about those things or getting new clothes. I just go to Salvation Army because I just don't care.
Right.
Or, you know, just live below your means kind of feeling.
Right. It's also humility. And that's not a word one applies to oneself, but that is a word that comes out of that living below your means and also being a reservoir available to others so that you're not spent when they call on you for help or when you organize these, whatever you organize as part of a...
Well, you can call it satisfaction. I would say that I have a quite happy life and I'm satisfied.
Yeah.
And, you know, people say, oh, some of my friends who have retired earlier say, you're just waiting so long to retire. You know, what happens if you drop dead the day after you retire? Well, you know, my life up until then, every single day has been good. I've done my traveling. I've done my stuff with friends. And so, you know, I hope to live for many a year, but I don't, it's not like I didn't do something that I really need to do.
Right. And my question to you would be, given the intense satisfaction that I see in your life, why do you really need to retire? You just want to break the pattern of these working arrangements now, but why bother?
Well, that's a great question. And there are times I say to myself, oh, I love the library. I love the people. I love meeting people who come by because I'm a clerk up at the front desk. I love seeing what books are out. I love working with children. I get a lot of good strokes from them, and they really appreciate me. Why stop? So my answer to that is, I want to try a new phase of my life. So the library, you have to either work there or not work there. So at some point, not too long from now, I will not work there. I could still go in and work with the kids either on a volunteer basis or once in a while subbing. So that one can be dialed back and I'd still have the satisfaction of being around the kids.
But you're describing a yearning. And what's driving this is you're yearning for something else right now. And do you know what that yearning is, or just the yen to go?
I guess it would be the yen to go. Sometimes my wife and daughter say, "We don't believe you've been a workaholic forever. We don't believe it." And I say to them, I roll up my sleeves and say, I'll show you." So I don't think it's in reaction to that. But
No, it doesn't seem at all like a reaction.
Well, I see lots of friends who've retired, and I have yet to meet someone who said, "Oh, I'm sorry I retired." And you know, people did jobs that they liked as well. So I guess what it is ready to see what happens next.
Yeah. I've known people who said that they were sorry that they retired, but and also mostly in the first year or two or three before they find their feet. But.
And I went to a retirement seminar 10 years ago when I first retired from teaching.
Right.
And the person who was giving the seminar said that there are two types of people. One that has the slate that's already filled in with everything they want to do, and then maybe the Zen one of like the empty sheet. Yeah. And I had been saying, oh, I'm probably some of both. I probably still am, but I think what I'm looking forward to is the empty slate part of it. Like, for instance, when I first retired, I did some volunteer work. I will plan to do so again, but I'm saying now at least that for the first year, I don't want to make – commitments like that, because I don't want my time to be taken up in such mm-hmm. a way that I don't find where I want to go.
Right.
And then, you know, once that unknown becomes a little bit more tangible, then I could start.
You can go towards it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What should we play next musically?
How much time do we have?
Well, we have time for a song now and then a song at the end, so two more.
Why don't we do Killing the Blues?
Okay.
Should I talk about it now?
Go right ahead. Yes.
Okay. Well, maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, I heard Robert Plant and Alison Krauss do that on a new album at the time called Raising Sand, and I just loved it. And so I figured out how to play it, and I brought it to my band at the time, which was Fall Creek Folk. Uh-huh. And we did a pretty nice job of it. I liked it quite a bit. We play it often, you know, I guess maybe it sings to some mm-hmm, degree, mm-hmm. but it's just a song that kind of shows some of what our band did. And this is one that I am singing and playing guitar on, and it's not perfect, but it's pretty good.
Good. Okay. Here we go. This is the Made of Clay Report, and you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and our guest on this hour is Richie Holtz, and that was his band, Fall Creek Folk, his old band, Killing the Blues. And so, Richie, one of the ways I like to kind of come to the close of the hour on the show is to look at, you know, what are the kinds of things that you do to restore yourself when you feel like your things are kind of getting off kilter, intellectually, emotionally, physically? What do you do to take yourself care of yourself in that way, those ways?
That's a good question. I would say number one is listen. I listen to my body, meaning that I generally go to bed early because, as my wife can attest to, when I get back from the library after teaching all day, then working at the library and having dinner, there's not that much that I'm really good for. If she asks me a question, I'm pretty surface at that point. I just don't have it in me. So I go to bed early and I wake up early. Let's see, I do yoga once a week. That's I haven't really integrated it as a practice in my life, but I go to a yoga class just because I believe in use it or lose it. So it's good to do that kind of things. Let's see. I also, as a kindergarten teacher for many years at parent-teacher conferences, I would often have to counsel parents, this too shall pass. You know, whatever behavior a kid is exhibiting, chances are it won't last. Not that you're not going to keep your eye on it, but most of the time those things
if you pay too much attention on it, you can freeze it in place.
Right.
If you, yeah.
And so, you know, especially, I hate to use the word wisdom, but as you get older, you know, you lose your hair, you lose this, you lose that. Maybe there's some kind of life experience that you do gain. I realize that just some things that one could get all bent out of shape about really aren't worth it because they're going to be gone in a couple of seconds, or they're just really not as meaningful as they seemed at first. So just learning how to not take so much to heart seems like a good practice.
Or not let your heart get bent out of shape for something that it's not really worth getting bent out of shape for.
Right. So that's physically going to bed early. You know, at this yoga class, we do some meditation, and I would say I'm a real neophyte at that. But it's nice to... I like to try to do a little bit of everything. I would say that I am, I do many things in moderation. Maybe I'm not passionate about doing any of them, but I figure, the use it or lose it, try to stay with as much in my game as I can. And it's not necessarily a conscious decision. I also love hiking and biking. As a matter of fact, with my impending retirement, I guess maybe, I don't know exactly what I was thinking, but I thought, well, maybe this could be a rehearsal for the retirement. And my wife and I, even during the school year at the beginning of, just about 3-4 weeks ago, we took a 3-week bike trip with the bikes on the back of the car, and then we would go and ride for a day or sometimes 2 days at a time and come back to the car. Through Massachusetts, Vermont, Cape Cod, Block Island, and we had just a terrific time. And it's good, you know, we didn't have to do 100 miles a day. We're not riding around Cayuga Lake. We did 20 miles a day, you know, something like that. And it was wonderful. It's not just about the biking. It's just about, that's part of the experience.
When you you haven't mentioned what you do to kind of restore your mind, your intellect.
Okay, well, that's assuming I've got it. Let's see.
Yes.
So I think I mentioned earlier on that I really like sitting down and doing puzzles, and I will just sit there and and just work it out. So yes, I do Sudoku puzzles and I do crossword puzzles. I also like to, you know, to talk and get into conversations with people and read new stuff. I read a lot. Both novels and then some informational type things, and try to bounce the ideas off to make sure I'm understanding them. that's what comes to mind right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds like, you know, the going to bed early, the weekly yoga class, those things are kind of scheduled. And the people, and when I ask this question of people, some people schedule their self-care because they need kind of the routine or the ritual to make sure that it happens. And some people merely notice when things are going a little off kilter, and this is when I need to go do something. And you seem to be kind of pretty tightly balanced right in the middle of both approaches.
Right. Like, I don't have a bedtime, but I get tired, so then I just
follow the cue. But it's early, and it's understood that it's going to be early by other people's standards.
Right. But then again, I joined a writing group because my daughter has been telling me for years. Oh, I just want to say she often has called the stories that I told about my travels her fairy tales, her bedtime. No, her I guess fairy tales growing up. You know,
yeah.
And they turned out to actually be true as said, and she would agree to that now, having experienced some of the people that I traveled with. So I went to start writing, but I just couldn't do it on my own. So I joined a group, and we met every other week, and I did some writing. And the same thing with the yoga. I don't do it at home.
Right.
But if I go to the class, especially since I've paid for the class, it gets me there. And so that's kind of routinized, and I do it. You know, mm-hmm, I'm anal enough to do the things that I say I'm going to do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you're an honest man. So, one of the things that it's fascinating that she described those as her myths or fairy tales or whatever of her childhood growing up, and that you were the narrator in that sense. You are a good story. Tell her. Are there any stories that we need to kind of close the show today with?
Oh my goodness. Okay,
or in anticipation of whatever, which of these songs you want to close the show with?
Well, I'm going to want to close it with Child of the Wind, but
yes.
the most obvious story to me is a group of us, meaning people from all different countries, were living in the park in Amsterdam in 1970, and we just would play music every day, mm-hmm, and come together in the evening, and we just had tarps. We would just roll up like burritos into the tarps at night if it happened to be raining. And a woman from a neighborhood would come by with her young children fairly often to hear our stories, to listen to the music. And many, many, many years later, she says, I was the person who invited her into the group to share. And then it was getting well into September, and she said, why don't you all come over to my house tonight for some dinner? We're talking about 14 people from different countries. So we stashed all of our stuff in the bushes in the park, went to her house, had this great dinner, and we noticed that it was starting to rain. So she said, why don't you go back, get the stuff you stashed there. You can get your sleeping bags. You can all sleep in my house. So we all did. We came back, and that night, we were talking about what to do next. And one American friend and I said, well, we're going to go to France to pick grapes. And there were three French people in the group. And they say, France is not very hospitable right now. That's why we're here in Holland. Why don't we all get a house together and we'll play some music, et cetera, et cetera. And the woman whose apartment we were in said, if you find a house that you like and the price is right, I will buy it. So one friend and I hitchhiked this 100 miles up to the North Sea the very next day when a Dutch friend showed us in the newspaper this really cheap place. We came back really excited to tell Catherine, this woman, about it. Another guy had hitchhiked up separately. She had already been up there, and she had already bought it. This house was, at the time, it was selling for 5,000 guilders, which was $2,800. She got it even cheaper than that because they were planning on bulldozing that whole area to make a road out to the islands, which were tourist islands. Mm-hmm. That was 1970. That house still exists. I was just, some friends actually precipitated into that spot and have been living there, and we go and visit them every couple of years.
Wow. Wow. So the story lives.
The story lives.
The story lives. The story lives. Richie, it's been great to get to know you. Do you want to say something about Child of the Wind before we...
Well, you know, okay, so in some ways, I'm very regimented because I've got to be at my jobs.
Right.
But Child of the Wind just sounds kind of ethereal. And
right.
So I like the sound of the title, but the song is beautiful. I'm yes. learning how to play it now.
Yes, yes.
And he does. Bruce Cockburn, again, does a great job on it.
Thank you, Richie.
My pleasure.
Really good to get to know you.
I love the pounding of hooves. I love engines that roar. I love the wild music of waves on the shore. And the spiral perfection of a hawk when it soars. I love my sweet woman down to the core. There's roads and there's roads, and they call, can't you hear it? Roads of the earth and roads of the spirit. The best roads of all are the ones that aren't certain. One of those is where you'll find me till they drop the big curtain. In the bright diamond sky, these mountains are waiting, brown, green, and dry. I'm too old for the term, but I'll use it anyway. I'll be a child of the wind till the end of my life.